This is the Wild Clearwater Country. Quick weather update for you. Looks like lots of stars and lots of sun. That's a good thing at night. It's a little painful right now, but I tell you, even in town, it's been nice to see so many stars. It's been clearing up. It seems to be a little less humid than it has been today. Give you some exact figures. They say it's going to be 55 degrees tonight. I'd like to see it. Tomorrow, 97 high. And then a low of 59 going into the weekend. We're seeing highs in the upper 80s and lows in the mid-50s through Monday. That's weather from Pullman Moscow Regional Airport. Well, Wild Clearwater Country show, just going to talk a little bit about the show, and we have some of our hosts will be arriving later in the show. I've been gone for a little while. I've been back east, so it's nice to be back on the show. Visited Virginia, home for my brother's wedding, and there's some nice spots, some nice roadless country in Virginia near where my parents live. Not the roadless country you have out here, not the hundreds of thousands of acres of roadless or millions of acres of wilderness that we have in Idaho. But fortunately, the governor of Idaho is a little more has a little more forethought. And I was one of the first governors to petition the administration for roadless protection, which it was received, as well as for a few other states like North Carolina, South Carolina, and I believe Maine. I'm not sure. Maybe New Mexico, too. But it's nice to be back in Idaho, a little less humid. So an announcement before we get going. Big, big, important meeting coming up tomorrow night, Thursday, July 27th, and this is in Moscow at the 1912 building. There is going to be a public meeting to discuss the draft plan for the Idaho Panhandle National Forest. Draft plans or forest plans come out about every 15 to 20 years. The last plan came out in 87, so we're going on 20 years, and the process to revise and design a new plan has been taking the last 3 or 4 years. So there will be a meeting. The forest has come out with a draft of this plan. There's some pretty big shortcomings to the plan, unfortunately, including not recommending any of the Mallard Larkin's Pioneer area or its famous lakes for wilderness, proposed wilderness, or the Little North Fork area for proposed wilderness. And additionally, the same goes for Grandmother Mountain, the closest roadless area to Moscow. I think a lot of people really enjoy and appreciate that place because it's close to home and they've spent some time there. And you probably know recently there were a few trails closed there to four-wheelers, which is a good thing, but we can do more and we can do better to protect that resource. And designating Grandmother Mountain or proposing it for wilderness is something we can and should do. And this plan has the ability to do that. Just some very general information about the plan is as they kind of cling to ambiguity and they don't provide enforceable standards to protect water quality and other values, something plans in the past have done. So we hope you attend that meeting. It's been organized by Palouse Group Sierra Club and Friends of the Clearwater. Again, it's 7 p.m., 1912 building, which is across from the high school on East 3rd Street in Moscow, 7 p.m., and a St. Joe District Ranger will be present. And just to add a little to that, this show is an independent show. It is not affiliated with any organization or group, and all the opinions expressed here are our own, which is kind of a nice, that's kind of a nice feeling to have, don't you think, James and Gary? It's kind of enjoyable.
Absolutely.
A little bit of freedom there.
Yeah, absolutely. Although we do talk about different activities of organizations on this show, this is simply to provide people with information.
That's right. That's right. And today we're going to provide you with quite a bit of information. We're going to be talking about off-road vehicles. We're going to be talking more about the Panhandle Forest Plan. And we're going to get into a little bit of music here first. And you know, we try not to think too highly of ourselves around here, but you know, just because this song is a favorite of mine, I'm going to play it. I'm not trying to insinuate in all that we are a famous radio show, but the song Fame just wouldn't get out of my head today. So here you go. All right, we're back on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. If you don't know who that is, just ask somebody, please. We're going to pass over to the Great Garbanzo to do a little discussion, talking a little bit about some off-road vehicle stuff.
That's right. We've got James Holt here with us. James is doing an internship with Friends of the Clearwater, and he's doing some off-road vehicle monitoring and also a project on non-forest products and how they may affect tribal treaty rights. James, of course, here is representing himself, as we all are. But James has in the past been on, I guess you're still on, a couple commissions for the Nez Perce Tribe, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, is that what it's called?
Yes, yes.
And that's just for, I guess, recognition purposes, as I am and will have jobs during the daytime with one of your local conservation organizations, Friends of the Clearwater. But, we're representing ourselves today. But we want to bring you some information about Friends of the Clearwater as a project. And so I thought I'd ask you a few questions here, James.
Sure.
Sort of what have you been finding out? You've been mainly on what, the Clearwater National Forest?
Yes, Clearwater National Forest. Most of my focus so far has been on the Weedus Creek. I've done a little bit of work on the Fish Creek as well, monitoring there. My main focus is to document what kind of use the trails are getting over the times I'm monitoring there for the hikers, the different uses, I suppose, the hikers, the ORVs, motorcycles, they're all represented out there, horses. So that's what I've been doing for.
Okay, so you've been out there on weekends when we expect to see a lot of folks out there. So what have you been finding? There's been some interesting things, as far as general use goes.
Well, I think much to my surprise, there's not near as much use on some of these trails as I had originally thought. For instance, out in the 12-mile saddle going up toward the Lolo Pass, there's been very little use on trails 174 and 164. And so I think that's the biggest surprise for me, is to see that there's not as much hiking pressure or use as I had originally thought.
That's right. I would expect to see a lot of people out there. And, of course, you didn't find anybody. And did you find any motor vehicle use or horse use there?
There was, as a matter of fact, when I showed up on Friday, this last Friday at 12 Mile Saddle, there was a number of Forest Service vehicles parked at the saddle. And there was a whole slug of employees that were just coming out of the Liz Creek cabin. I guess they're doing a bunch of remodel work down there.
Oh.
So that was about the most use I've seen today.
And that was from the Forest Service.
Yeah.
Interesting. So we're not seeing a lot of use out there. Do you have any guesses as to why a place like 12 Mile Saddle, which is popular, the headwaters of Weedus Creek, and it also that 164 trail goes up on Windy Ridge, and you know, it's some pretty spectacular country up toward Cook Mountain. You can take some other side trails down into Weedus Drainage or into the 4th of July Creek and country. I just wondered if you had any guesses or ideas of what may be happening.
I'm curious as well. The 12 Mile Saddle is located on the old Lolo Trail, the motorway, and, you know, this being a big hoopla for the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, I had thought that would push users to go and see those same areas. And especially, like you said, the 164 trail is a wonderful trail to go hike. There's so much opportunity out there to be alone with yourself or your companions and just to see some beautiful unroaded areas. And so I'm very curious as to where the use is happening.
Huh. And so we're seeing less use, it sounds like, just about of everything, not just hiking, but motors, vehicles as well, and horseshoes. That's a surprise, 12 Mile Saddle, because this is the hoopla year, as whoever's were saying, and it's ended. And surprisingly, the Forest Service ended their permit system on that 500, the Lolo Motor Trail or Motorway or something like that. They ended the permit system because of the lack of use.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, the most of the use I think I've witnessed to date would be at the lower end of the Weedus Creek, where it dumps into the North Fork, and that is a big weekend spot down there for campers and fishermen. So that's the majority of the use has been down to other end of the Wheatus Creek.
So, yeah, let's switch there. What did you find down there in terms of use at the other end of Wheatus Creek?
Well, a lot of ORVs are going up. They are allowed to go up up to Johnson Creek, I believe the name of it is. So there's mostly just ORV use down there. And the fishermen, the few hikers I have talked to up near the guard station, they'd rather not go down there just because of the ORVs. You know, even though the trail ends a little ways up, they just would rather go into an area where there's not as much competition for the big fish, you know, and just that type of a situation. So they've pretty much chosen the areas from my interviews with hikers up upstream from the guard station itself.
Ah, now that's a fascinating topic. So this is the middle part, of course, of Wheatus Creek. There's that one road that goes right down to the guard station, and there's that old beat-up road that they don't maintain that kind of goes across on that bridge. So in that part, it goes in dead ends, and then all surrounding it kind of in a horseshoe shape, so all this roadless country surrounding that road. So they're going upstream. That's interesting. So did you find any fish? What's the fish like this year out there?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not good enough to get any of the big boys out of there. So I can tell you about a whole bunch of smaller fish, but the fishing's good. The fishing is good.
All right. Interesting. Okay. So that was Wheatus Creek. Rather interesting. Upper, lower, middle, not as much use as we would expect for such a year. Folks in the backcountry, and I had a speculation a while back, you know, that of course the Forest Service did close the permit system. They said they didn't need to do it anymore. I'm just wondering if gas prices are having an effect on people going out. If that's a possibility?
You know, I've seen some news clips on the news, and I've read that gas prices aren't keeping people away from traveling. And so where they're traveling to is the next question. I mean, I don't know that, because the feds seem to think that there's not any drop in amount of travel.
That's interesting. And I've seen the same news one. So I guess that really is a question, because finding very little use out in some of those places. So what did you find on Fish Creek? Now, Fish Creek's a pretty famous area. It's just on the other side of Wheatus Creek, just kind of a little bit to the south and I guess to the west. It's a roadless area that is adjacent to the Wheatus Creek roadless area, but it's got that 500 road we talked about, that Mololo motorway road divides the two areas from each other. It starts flowing a little bit east, kind of a backwards thing, and then flows south into the Locksaw rather than the North Fork like Wheatus Creek. So what did you find there?
Well, there was some hiker use the one time I was there, which I was glad to see, because it's always nice to see that these trails are being used in this way. And so, otherwise, I hiked on down into the Fish Creek, and it was just a beautiful area. Some of the sections of trail just are pristine in itself. Even though you're on a maintained trail, it's almost like the trail is a natural occurrence. And so some of the whole experience of the pristine forest and the clear, beautiful stream that Fish Creek is, it's wonderful, wonderful land to be out on.
One of the things I like about Fish Creek is the fact that it's one of the most important steelhead streams in Idaho, and I guess if not the most important, and it's also got salmon in it, a few salmon.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Salmon run up that, especially now with the increased recovery efforts of the tribe and the state in the Locksaw drainage itself.
And that is right. We're seeing some pretty what we hope can be significant recovery in places like Fish Creek, again, a nice and a fine, like Wheatus Creek, to find wilderness candidates there in the roadless portion of those areas, a couple of great candidates for wilderness.
So I had a quick question about Lolo Motorway. Now, the motorway was finally cleared along its entirety just recently, right, from winter debris etc. Is this portion a 12-mile saddle? It's been open for quite a while, though. So I'm just speculating. I wonder if users are going to wait even longer. I wonder if it's a fall or late summer destination. The only time I've spent there in the past was in late July, I believe, last year. And I wonder if folks are waiting to hear the official announcement from folks at the Forest Service before they head up there. Just a guess. Any thoughts on that, you guys?
That's an interesting point. I mean, maybe everybody thinks that everybody and their dog's out there for this Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, so the real users of the hikers that are there all the time, maybe they're deciding that they'd like to wait out the crowds when the crowds themselves aren't coming.
That is, I think you might have hit on it there, James.
Maybe they were worried there was a toll booth set up.
In fact, it was, like, say, a permit system, and a lot of people didn't know the Forest Service canceled that. So maybe, indeed, that might be what's what's happening there. And, of course, being a little higher up, we might have to wait maybe for hunting season and do some monitoring then.
Are those big signs still up there?
Oh, yeah. They're beautiful signs, too.
big signs. Yeah. And that's, of course, that route there is a very historical and important route. It's been used for millennia by Nez Perce people, and then Lewis and Clark, I guess, came on that and sort of got lost a little bit. One has to wonder how they did that, but they got lost out at Hungry Creek somehow. But quite some famous spots up along that route.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say to all the hikers out there that they should go into these areas. I mean, there's not much use. There's not a lot of competition. There's a lot of solitude to be had out there, and just a lot of beauty in its natural state. So
that's one of the great things about the Clearwater Country, I think, James, is that there are some great areas people can get away from, all these wild areas, and of course they need protection. And I'd like to see them protected as wilderness, but that these areas really are spectacular chunks of land, like you say, the backcountry.
Well, I think we're going to get into a little bit more music here.
Okay, you've got something picked out for us,
something
Will?
For you guys. It's a new title for me, Greta Matassa. Sorry, Greta, if I messed up your last name. She does some nice vocalizations using some, as her mentors, some famous folks you might have heard of, such as Sarah Vaughan, Peggy Lee, and Shirley Horn. So here's some Greta.
Some jazz singing.
Sweet and lovely, sweeter than the roses in May. Sweet and lovely, heaven must have sent him my way. Skies above me never were as blue as his eyes, and he loves me. Who would want a sweeter surprise? When he nestles in my arms so tenderly, there's a thrill that words cannot express. In my heart a song of love is taunting me, melody haunting me. Sweet and lovely, sweeter than the roses in May. And he loves me, there is nothing more I can say. God must have set in my way. Skies above me never were as blue as his eyes. And he loved me. Who would want a sweeter surprise? When he nestles in my arms so tenderly, there's a thrill that words cannot express. In my heart a song of love is taunting me, melody haunting me.
All right, that's Greta Matassa from Favorites from a Long Walk. That track is called Sweet and Lovely. Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. We're talking about ORVs.
Off-road vehicles, scourge of wild country. And I'm talking here with James Holt, who's doing some inventorying of off-road vehicle use and hiking use and horseback use and motorcycle use and other kinds. On trails that were originally designed for foot and foot travel by horses and humans. So I know maybe it's a little segue here, James, and talk, your suggestion, a little bit about some of the impacts of off-road vehicles on wild country and wildness. And for, if anyone is interested, there is a great resource on the web that talks about and gives citations for hundreds, literally hundreds of studies that have addressed this question in various, various forms. And that's an organization called the Wildland Center for Preventing Roads. And their website is www.wildlands, one word, wildlands, then just the letter CPR. wildlandscpr.org. And their website contains a wealth of information about the effects on different aspects of the environment. And I'm just wondering if you noticed anything. Of course, there wasn't that much use, so you may not have seen much, James, but did you notice much effect this year?
Well, down in the Fish Creek was the only place that I thought I had seen use by an ORV on a walking path, mm-hmm. and of course that was early on in the summertime, and there was a lot of vegetation out, and mm-hmm. so I didn't really see a lot of impacts there, mm-hmm. but you know, looks can be deceiving. You know, mm-hmm. it could be that ORV had some noxious weeds hanging inside of its frame of its vehicle or something. So maybe the impacts aren't going to be felt for another year or two.
Oh, and you bring up an important point. You just mentioned noxious weeds. That website I just gave earlier has some information about weeds. And, in fact, weeds tend to spread almost exclusively along roads and trails where vehicles are allowed. That tends to be the easiest way to spread. And, of course, sometimes they also spread through the use of horses if they're not eating the right stuff, you know, on trails. But that's the way vehicles are, just tend to be the big primary spreader of weeds. In fact, it's been logging vehicles. They think that spread spotted knapweed throughout the road system throughout the Clearwater Country and then eventually onto trails. Weed spread is one. The Upper Fish Creek, there's an interesting story behind that. A few years ago, some ORVs got down there in the middle of the summer and kind of tore around that little meadow area and tore it up a bit, and causes erosion, and of course that affects fish habitat, and there's also some research on that as well. A vehicle, unlike a walker or even a horse, has that constant. It creates a constant stream for erosion, whereas, because the wheels are always on the ground, whereas when you walk, you're lifting your feet up. At least most of us lift our feet up when we walk, and therefore you don't have that same kind of an impact, but a wheel creates a constant stream. So you have some erosion impacts. That area was closed in an emergency closure, and that trail is, of course, closed to vehicles, but some people illegally go down into Fish Creek still, so That's some of them. One of the other interesting ones, and the effects on the environment, are on wildlife. And there's been a lot of research, again, that website, www.wildlandscpr.org, has a lot of information about wildlife and the effects on different kinds of wildlife. Access for rare critters like grizzlies or wolverines, motorized access can often spell doom because they tend to conflict with humans, and grizzlies people are afraid of or they want to shoot. And two things that happen there: it's the frequency and the lethality of the contact with humans. In other words, heavily armed humans on and have easy access, frequent access. Usually that requires motors to be really, really frequent and fast, because you can get into country, pass through a lot more country and affect it than you can on foot, because you're moving at a much, much faster rate on a vehicle. So they have a greater impact. They're heavily affected. But elk habitat, especially, talked a lot about elk on this show. But that's one of the prime factors in reduction in elk are open roads and open trails to vehicles. And in fact, for trails to be, fairs to be truly effective, secure places for elk, they need to be close to motorized vehicles. And in fact, the Forest Service, the Clearwater National Forest, has a standard in their forest plan for various areas. In some areas, they say there should be no motor vehicles, and of course, they're not enforcing it, unfortunately, to protect elk, what they call 100% elk habitat effectiveness in the summer. There's a lot of research that shows that. Recently, Trout Unlimited and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation came out with some articles in their publications about roadless areas and the importance of them to hunting, and finding out that roadless areas and wilderness areas where vehicles are not permitted have the highest, in the state of Idaho, for example, have the most secure habitat for elk and other big game species.
That's right, and not to promote trophy hunting at all, because I think it's appalling, but that's where the big game animals were found, mm-hmm. too, in roadless.
And there are a lot of people that go out there that love to hunt in the wilderness, and, you know, and that's how they feed themselves and their families. And that's when you don't have as many, when animals are affected by a lot of motorized use, then you don't have that ability to go out and collect, you know, food for your family.
Yeah, ORVs, I think what's one thing that's interesting about ORVs is, like James kind of brought up, the things you can't see. You can tell maybe with a mud path, you can see that impression in the ground. You can see that the soil is being compacted, nothing's growing there, or maybe you can just tell that some erosion has occurred, especially when it's a wetter time of year. One thing that interested me are the actual physical things that happen when a motorized vehicle's wheels go across the ground, and what that actually does to plants and animals. I remember the first time I ran into an ORV when hiking. Not only was it a disturbance to me and having to move off the trail a couple different times and look back and make sure that we weren't going to get hit by someone coming down the trail, but the number of small mammals that were killed that we saw baffled me. And also, which you can see, but the things you can't are some of the plant damage that occurs, some of the roots that are severed, plants that will not grow back because the roots have been severed, damage to the plants above the ground as well. And I wonder if there's any research at all. I know in areas that are considered to be a natural habitat but are in proximity to road have seen some of the problems that are caused by exhaust. And I wonder if some of these more heavily used trails show any signs of that exhaust. It'd be interesting to see if there is research out there like that.
Yeah, and I bet that the website may have some information about that, because exhaust from vehicles going everywhere, of course, almost all of us use vehicles, but if we go everywhere with them rather than spending a little time out in the backcountry, you know, that adds to the consumption of fossil fuels. If you drive in some place and carry an off-road vehicle with you, and then you drive from there somewhere else rather than walking or riding a horse, then you there's an additional element of exhaust that's added into that equation. And I think that's an important issue, pollution. One of the interesting things is many of these off-road vehicles, not all, but many of them, some of the motorcycles, for example, are two-stroke engines in some of the snowmobiles, although they're trying to change some more to the four-stroke. The two-stroke tend to be more polluting than a traditional car or truck, which are different engines. They tend to produce a lot of pollution, and that's been a big concern. In wintertime use, the compaction, the plant damage you talked about, is even evident on snowmobiles. They say, oh, of course, they're on top of snow. They don't have an effect. Well, you go back to some areas, and Keith Hammer in northwest Montana has documented the impacts of snowmobiles, and they create almost the equivalent of new trails and roads, erosion paths right there from just snowmobile use on places in the winter. And he's photo-documented all of this, and it's really amazing, the effects. One of the other interesting things about a wintertime use, we've talked about some rare critters on the show in the past with ORVs and or snowmobiles in the wintertime, security for things like lynx and wolverine. Wolverines move out of areas where these snowmobiles go. So, you know, that's one of the big concerns with off-road vehicles as well. So there's a lot of research out there about the impacts, especially in unroaded areas, the few quiet areas. The Clearwater National Forest has approximately 4,000 plus miles of roads on it, and that's plenty. It doesn't have that many trails, and there needs to be a lot of some few quiet areas for folks. Well, Will, I'm wondering if we ought to switch gears here a little bit and ask James a little bit about the project. Another project he's working on is sort of finding out how the agencies manage non-forest commercial products, things like, I guess, berries would be one, and mushrooms, of course, after fire. We talked a little bit about the school fire and the effects of, potential effects of mushroom gathering and other kinds of use upon treaty rights. And I just wonder if you'd put any thought into that and wondering sort of, you know, what's happening.
Sure. Thanks, Gary. For the last 10 years, the Nez Perce tribe has been concerned, our elders have been concerned about the amount of pressure that is being placed on the resources of the huckleberries and other roots and berries that the tribe has traditionally used for subsistence. As far as we can tell, there hasn't been a whole lot of monitoring or regulation by the Forest Service of these resources, and our elders are saying that they're beginning to see a lessening of the resource out there. There's not as much berries. They're not getting as big as they used to be. And I guess we could attribute a lot of this to some of these commercialized methods that people are utilizing to harvest these berries and the roots. And so my effort is just like a preliminary research into, what does the Forest Service have in place right now? Where do they plan on taking it? And how will this affect the Nez Perce tribe's tree rights and the way of life that we enjoy to this day?
I think that's an important issue to look at. It's very interesting because people know quite a bit about the Forest Product Program. The Forest Service, it's very controversial in some respects, their logging program, the way it's conducted, but it is very much out in the open, or tends to be out in the open, and people tend to know about it. But this other one, there isn't much of a policy, doesn't seem like. And that's sort of what you're looking into, is to what is the policy of the Forest Service and how they go about handling these kind of issues.
Sure. I think we've seen in the past, you know, with logging as one, where unchecked harvesting can really damage a resource. We've seen it with the salmon runs. And, you know, here we go again. And in the view of many Native American, Native people, that, you know, here we are again, just finding another way to exploit a resource from Mother Earth, and they're doing it with no real framework in place that ensure the protection of these resources for our future generations.
So that'll be interesting, James. We may have to have you back on the show once you find out a little bit more. I know you've been trying to get in touch with the Forest Service and see sort of what mechanisms they have in place. And preliminarily, it doesn't seem like there's a lot, but once we have some more information, we'd love to have you back.
Thanks, Kenny.
Well, Will, we're getting to a couple other issues, kind of segue time. Is it time for our awards, or do you think we ought to go with the Idaho Panhandle? We'll talk a little bit about that.
Oh, let's give an award out. It's time for an award.
Okay,
we need to loosen it up.
Bounding of drums. That's the drum roll and this week we have a different one.
That's right.
This week, in place of the Whopper, we're going to give a natural wild elk steak.
Ooh, and
instead
steak,
of a Whopper,
not
this
even
is
a
good. This is a different
man,
award. This is the good award.
I'd like
this
to
is
get
something
that
different.
Award.
All right,
a wild elk steak. That anyway, and this one goes to an interesting media source this week. In yesterday's, last night's, in fact, paper, the Moscow Pullman Daily News, the editorial page had a great article about this Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act, which would basically compromise the values of wilderness by down around the Boulder White Clouds area in south central Idaho. And this bill would give away a lot of the public land to 5,000 plus acres. You know, the numbers keep changing. Nobody really knows. To private interests, including land that was in private ownership into the Sawtooth National Recreation Area that was bought by taxpayer dollars, so it would be held in trust, some winter range for elk. That's going to be sold for some trophy home development. And this bill to get some pieces of the Boulder White Clouds in exchange designated as wilderness. Well, the problem is, the wilderness down there, there's so many exceptions in this bill, the area really isn't going to be treated as wilderness. The thing there's motorized use is going to be allowed under certain circumstances, helicopters and all sorts of things for so-called necessary things like wildlife, fire, and all this sort of other things. And in generally, fire and wilderness, yes, that is one of the exceptions motorized use is allowed. But this allows local governments, not the federal government, this allows the county to go out there and decide what to do in wilderness. And that's sort of taking away the public's right of being public lands to all nations to a very local county. So for that editorial, which questioned this bill, and this bill was passed kind of in a rushed through the House of Representatives in sort of some sort of secret little process, bypassing the normal rules, even though there were some problems with it, kept it out of the open, no sunshine on it, you know, sort of buried it, and they said it was non-controversial. When all these concerns were raised about it, they said, hey, this needs to have a thorough airing. So because of their courageous editorial stance, Moscow Pullman Daily News gets the big elk steak. Yeah.
Enjoy.
A big wild elk steak, so there we go.
Thanks for airing it out. Let it see the light of day.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, well, that trophy home development, I wish you wouldn't even use that term, Gary. It gets my dander up.
Yeah. Oh, that's what they call it.
The failure of capitalism.
Yeah, these big, huge, gigantic monster houses and far bigger than anybody would ever need. And people aren't going to live in them. These are like second and third
second
homes.
Home. You should have a home. You should have a house cap. You're allowed one house, you know.
Yeah,
you
know, most people can live in, you know. I mean, a lot of people don't even have one house, you know. They're renting in an apartment or something, or, you know, let alone how many houses, you know. This just does show. I think, well, that's a great way to put it, the failure of capitalism. But that's what this bill has now passed the House. Kind of got snuck through on it in a kind of a corrupt process. Now we'll have to wait to the Senate and see what Idaho Senator Larry Craig does on this. It'll be very interesting. He has not taken a public position on it. He's somewhat skeptical about parts of this bill. Let's hope. Although he's not particularly been a friend of wilderness in the past, maybe. Maybe he can be convinced. And
yeah.
He's coming into Moscow on August 23rd for a town meeting. And
that's
people
right.
maybe can talk to him about this and some other things and local concern here.
Yeah, that's going to be a good opportunity. I know for a fact that every call into his Lewiston office mm-hmm. concerning CEDRA, yeah. the Central Idaho Economic Development Act, has been against it.
Yeah,
so his constituents are...
Yeah, a little bit concerned. Yeah. So there we go. The elk steak of the week.
And, you know, just to continue the steak, mm-hmm. we'll just hand the steak around mm-hmm. a little bit to the folks over down there on... Is that on Jackson Street?
Uh-huh.
At the Daily News. Good position on the Cedar Grove as well.
That's right.
A month or two back by the editor, Steve McClure, just in support of local control for that important resource to this town.
Yeah, because it's again, that's state land up there. The state doesn't have a process, unfortunately, like the public lands managed by the federal government for protection, short of a state park designation, and for that to change from Department of Lands, the state Idaho Department of Lands, to state parks would require the state parks to pay the Department of Lands because these are supposedly supposed to make money for the schools. Of course, there's another issue there that we're not addressing, and that is that the grazing permits don't make money on the state lands. In fact, they lose money, but that's a whole other topic of discussion. But nonetheless, there's going to be a program now where the county is wanting, because of the interest of local citizens, to protect the watershed and to protect this important little natural area that people go to protect that. So that's a good editorial position as well, and we're going to see hopefully some protection of cedars here in and around Moscow.
Yeah.
Instead of seeing them shipped away as shingles and cedar shakes and posts, these big old cedars, they'll be protected for a while. Well, Will, a little bit about the Idaho Panhandle National Forest.
Some...
You talk to tomorrow, 1912 building, 7 yeah. o'clock. Come on, some refreshments, and ask a few hard questions of the district ranger. It's really a funny time. It's kind of a sad time. The Forest Service is going through their planning process. Now, these forest plans are supposed to last 10 years, although they can last up to 15. Well, this plan has been in place for for about 19 years. So they're way behind in their planning.
Yeah, it'll be definitely 20 before it comes out.
Comes out in final form. It's right now in draft form. They're only just giving it out to people to collect input, but they're not doing an analysis of the environmental impacts of this plan. And they're saying that the plans have no effect on the environment. Well, that's foolish, because if the Forest Service were to recommend, for example, some nice roadless areas like all of Mallard Larkins, the famous Mallard Larkins for wilderness, that would have an effect, a positive effect on the environment. But this plan is open for public comment until August 10th, and people can contact Friends of the Clearwater, 882-9755 locally, for areas in the Idaho Panhandle National Forest. The very southern end of it is in the wild Clearwater country, the upper St. Joe, and, of course, the little North Fork Clearwater River are there. And the little North Fork used to have salmon and steelhead in it, but I guess no more since Dvorak. Well, that's an unfortunate change, but it'd be nice to get wild salmon back up there. But and one of the craziest recommendations I think we've seen, the Forest Service didn't recommend any of the famous Mallard Larkins Pioneer Area for wilderness, rather having some kind of bizarre special management area for up there, and it's kind of unclear as to what the intent or the goal of that is. So that means if anybody's familiar with that country, if you go up, let's say, Surveyor Ridge Road, that kind of road that's excluded, a road corridor that's excluded from the roadless area and from the wilderness, because it is a road, proposed wilderness, if you hike from there on up to Skyland Lake or Fawn Lake or Hart Lake, the really famous one where a lot of people see mountain goats, or Hero Lake, Nant Lake, a lot of those, Larkins Lake, go up around Mulligan Hump or the Devil's Pulpit. You know, if you look at those kind of peaks that are there, or anything north of Mallard Peak, guess what? That's not recommended as wilderness. Sawtooth Creek, which was in the previous recommendation, Sawtooth Saddle, Sawtooth Peak, all that great country is not 1 acre is being recommended for protection, even though the Forest Service in the past, even that agency, which doesn't particularly like wilderness, recommended it. Not even that. They're only recommending a portion along the St. Joe Wild and Scenic River Corridor from Heller's campground on up to there, because there's a road there into there, but that roadless stretch from there down to Spruce Tree. They didn't recommend it, the very, very tip upper end of the St. Joe River and St. Joe Lake for wilderness, unfortunately, nor did they, which is a very unique lake, and it's a wild and scenic river all the way up to the lake. This lake is one of the few lakes that had fish populations in it naturally. It's not that those lakes, most of these high alpine lakes are in these cirques and they drop off really steep, so fish didn't ever get up there. This one is a little less steep and fish can make it up. It has bull trout in it, bull trout and West Slope cutthroats. So rather unique, at least that's reportedly, rather unique system there. They didn't stock that lake up there for whatever reason in the early days, and so it's got some pure strain fish in that St. Joe River system. That area was not recommended either, which is contiguous to wild country on the Clearwater National Forest. And Mallard Larkins itself is divided about equally half and half between the Clearwater National Forest and the Idaho Panhandle. Well, on the Idaho Panhandle side, again, just that St. Joe portion, none of the country, as I mentioned there in the Pioneer area, none of that Little North Fork, that wild canyon, that really neat canyon of the Little North Fork down there by Trapper's Cabin, where Larkins Creek comes in, or where Canyon Creek comes in, or where Sawtooth Creek comes in, really nice, beautiful section. Clearwater River, it gets pretty big and wild there. Buzzard Roost on the other side, and Joker Peak, and where Fall Creek comes in. That area is some of the wildest country in Idaho. Very, very remote. It's tough to get to. In fact, if anybody that's a kayaker or canoeist or rafter knows, once you get below Fall Creek, there's no trail along the Little North Fork, and so there's several miles of that before it hits slack water and some roaded country there in Dworshak of wild river. It's pretty remote and pretty neat. And none of that country, in fact, it's under this vague, what they call backcountry category, which allows road building and logging and all sorts of things, even though it's kind of protected, but kind of not. This very ambiguous plan. So that's a problem, a huge problem in that area. All the Mallard Larkins, all of that upper St. Joe, upper North Fork Clearwater country needs to be recommended as wilderness, as well as does Grandmother Mountain, and you'd mentioned that earlier. None of that's recommended. There's a part that's an old wilderness study area because some of it used to be managed by the Bureau of Land Management, and they have a slightly different process in the Forest Service, but because of the land exchanges and whatnot, the land ownership there is all public but kind of oddly mixed between the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. One agency sort of needs to take the lead on that, I think. None of that's recommended, nor that very famous Pinchot Marsh area,
yeah,
which has got some unique bogs in it. So I'd encourage people to come to that meeting and write a letter to the Forest Service. And a couple other points, Will, that I think ought to be mentioned about the Idaho Panhandle. And anybody can, if you want to come on in and make any other recommendations. One is the new forest planning regulations really violate the National Forest Management Act of 1976. They don't require water quality to be protected. They don't have any measurable standards. So the Forest Service can claim, no matter what they do, that they're following their forest plan, because if you don't have a standard or some way to measure success, then you know, you can do anything and say you're doing just the opposite of what's really happening on the ground. So they have no measurable standards. Right now they have water quality measurements that they're required to meet, certain parameters like measuring sediment, measuring cobble embeddedness, which is a measure of sediment.
That would throw out DEQ's sub-basin reports right out the window.
Basically, yeah, and those aren't all that good. And even then they would be thrown out. They wouldn't even be they're not even going to meet that low standard. They wouldn't, you know, certain pollutants. They're not meeting those standards at all in the forest plan for fish. And these were developed for these, you know, West Slope cutthroats of bull trout, which are important in both of those areas, all those creeks. So that's one thing the plan doesn't have. It doesn't have a standard for retention of snags, old dead wood. And we've talked about the importance of dead wood on this show. Or older forests, ancient forests, old growth. There are no standards. They say, well, we're going to have some, but they don't say how much they need to have. And so they'll just say it's good to have some, but if there's no way to measure it, if there's no standard to meet, how can they meet that? No soil standards for soil quality in terms of soil compaction, logging, road building, and all those other things, and off-road vehicles, compact soil. Again, with no measurement, no standards that are enforceable, and the forest plans are enforceable, then I can't do that. You can't just say, well, we have some guidelines that suggest we do these. Those are not enforceable. They can always give an excuse to say, well, it's not enforceable. So that another huge problem with these forest plans. And they've also missed some areas in their wilderness inventories on the Mallard Larkins, some of the spotted Lewis Creek country, and the Bad Bear Creek, which is unroaded, was not even considered roadless. And this country is unroaded and part of Mallard Larkins, and they missed it. Just a bad inventory all the way around. So there you have it.
There you go.
Comments are due on August 10th. More information can be obtained at www.wildrockies.org/FOC. Look under What's New. And there's an alert there on Idaho Panhandle National Forest, or IPNF, and it will tell you where to write and what to do and come to the meeting.
Yeah, and if you're new to the area and you don't know your way around and you want to know more about the forest, this is a great opportunity. There will be a ton of people there who have knowledge of this forest. There's going to be some great maps, hopefully, and it's a good opportunity to network and also learn a little bit more about on the ground and also share the knowledge you have of the places that are important to you in the Panhandle Forest. So,
hey, we're getting down to be about that time.
Yeah, it is.
It's just about the end of the Wild Clearwater Country show. James, thanks for coming on the show with us.
You betcha. You betcha.
Any last words?
Just to behoove all the citizens to be active in their communities and for the resources that they care about.
All right. Great words.
All right. For the famous Mallard Larkins.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies, who reviews the chronology of events that led to Israel's attack on Lebanon and the U.S. role in the conflict. Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association, who examines Bush's rationale for his signing statements and the danger the practice poses to American democracy. And Esther Kaplan, author of the book With God on Their Side, who discusses President Bush's recent veto of stem cell research legislation and the Christian fundamentalist movement's growing influence on U.S. public policy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Ethiopia has intervened in neighboring Somalia by sending troops and vehicles to defend the weak United Nations-recognized interim government based in the town of Baidoa. The interior